Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Stormkeep. My name is Paul, and today I am joined by my friend Sarah. We played a game together for our local store league, and we thought we'd do a battle report about it because it showed off a lot of interesting tactical stuff.
Hey, everyone, I'm Sarah. I was playing Skaven against Paul for the league at our local store, and it was a fun game, but a short game, so we'll run you through it as best we can.
Well, I suppose we should start by talking about our store league, the setup for it, and how it differs from a lot of other events that people are doing. So the store league that they're running around here is basically a GT in the sense that there's five games and then you determine a winner after those games. But you know the battle plans ahead of time for each, and it's done over a period of, what do we have, like 15 weeks total, right?
Yes, it's 3 weeks per round, so five times. So yeah, 15 weeks lasts about like 3 months.
Yeah, and we know ahead of time what all the battle plans are going to be, but we don't know the other players' lists. And all the pairings are done randomly, through, I think it's Swiss pairings, right? Where winners, seeds play against other winners, and then the bottom seeds play against other seeds, something like that. Anyway,
it's random based off win path, pretty much.
Okay, that's a better, more concise way of saying it. I'm not really good at using words. So we knew ahead of time this would be Geomantic Pulse. We had no idea we would be playing each other. There's a lot of other people. I think there's like 15 people that would have been at this point. There's 30-ish total in the league. So there was a lot of variety. It could have been a whole different bunch of different number of lists. So our lists were not tailored to playing against each other, but they were tailored to the battle plan, at least as much as you can tailor in this league, right? Depends on what models you own and what you want to play and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, so let's talk about Geomantic Pulse. So this is, the first battle plan in the book. You open up the book and this is the first one. And I really like it. I've played it a few times now, especially preparing for last week's round. I played a lot of matches on this one. And at first I thought I wouldn't like it because for most of the game, like 3 out of the 5 rounds, there's only 0 or 2 objectives active. And I thought that would be pretty distasteful. But it's actually turned out to be one of my favorite maps this season. I really, really like it.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting.
Yeah, the main gimmick here is that there's a pulse that happens at the top of round 2, chosen by the player going second. They can either choose A or B to be the pulse, and then it moves either from A to B or from B to A, one node each round. So the total victory points you can get each round are you can control an objective. You can get 2 points for controlling the pulse. You can control the objective left of the pulse. You can control the objective to the right of the pulse. And you can do a battle tactic. So it's not quite the usual control one, control two, control more setup. It's a variable scoring. You can get 3 in round 1, and then 6, then 7 and 7 in round 3 and 4, and then 6 in round 5. So I like that aspect of it. I like that it's backloaded points. I like any game that kind of prolongs it so that it's not just, you know, turn 1 and 2 and then the game's over, right? Like a lot of times you figure out who wins by top of round 2 initiative, and that's usually not very interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it was a little daunting to get through all the rules for the first time, but once you get how the scoring works and what it is per round, it's a lot easier to get through.
Mm-hmm. I really like this one in particular because I like playing a slower, more tactical, methodical chess-like game where you're kind of, you know, poking, prodding, trying to find weaknesses, trying to find angles, and this battle plan plays into that perfectly because there's almost nothing to do on round 1. All you have to do is score a battle tactic and be on one objective, and there's 4, so like, you know, because you and your opponent don't want to overextend onto one side of the board in case the pulse is on the other side, what happens is round 1 is usually very calm and both players just sort of feel each other out, don't commit resources, they just position and posture for round 2. That's a kind of gameplay you haven't really gotten a lot of in the past few seasons. It's been pretty rare. Most of the time, it's like objectives are so important. You know, you have to max score every single round and you have to overextend. And this is just chill. That first round, especially in this game that we played, almost nothing happens, right? Like, I think, I don't want to spoil what happened, but not much.
Yeah, it was very, very slow until it suddenly wasn't. But I, on one hand, for my army at least, I don't like that there's no home objectives, but I agree with you. I do like the backloaded scoring because typically how my list would play in most matches is I want to sit back and then move out in the later rounds to really secure the board once I've dealt with most of the threats. But so this actually kind of works for me depending on the matchup here.
Mm-hmm. I suppose the last thing worth mentioning about Geomantic Pulse is that the territories are small, and that's not usually how the territories look in battle plans in Age of Sigmar, right? Like this 11-inch up the board, quarter deployment, hammer and anvil style, that's not typical until this season, right? And this season, this is becoming more and more common. But until this recent GHB, this deployment setup was rare. But on when you have this kind of 22-inch gap between player territories, that means it's a lot easier to deploy units out of unbinding range, deploy units out of like 30-inch threat ranges, which is very common in this game, especially with a lot of spells being, you know, you teleport 9 inches away and then you have like some 18-inch cast, right? So 30 inches mm-hmm. is like a magic number in this game. And having a 22-inch deployment between really makes it easier to stay out of that stuff. But then for battle tactics too, right? Scoring intimidate the invaders and surround and destroy is very easy on this battle plan. Especially because on this battle plan, you want to be near the edge in round two. So setting up round one for a round two surround and destroy is very, very easy to do, especially compared to other battle plans that have to, oh, you have to do so much more effort. This is a lot easier.
There are some where you just look at it and go, well, this is a surround and destroy is a lost cause.
Yeah. And I feel like the battle tactics were not really the deciding factor between our armies, given that Stormcast and Skaven are probably the worst battle tactics in the game, right? Our two armies are just terrible at them.
Yep. So that battle scroll can't come fast enough.
Soon.
Warhammer community did just post that the 40K one is coming out on Thursday, I think, the 7th.
Oh, okay.
So I wonder if that means they'll release the AOS one at the same time or maybe delay it to next week.
It's usually the week after.
Yeah.
So if you're watching this video when it comes out, then maybe you just have to wait a week and hopefully there's some new battle tactics or point changes or who knows. Something good is probably going to happen. Because
mm-hmm.
they can't let our army sit at 40% win rate, you know? Just can't do it.
I don't know. They've done worse. They might be okay with it. I'd like them to fix it, but we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the list. Let's talk about yours first, why you built it the way you did. We could talk about specifically why you went for two drops. I know you got the double lightning cannon, and I'm curious to know what your thoughts are about having two drops in this current season. And I guess how much did the list that people were playing in the previous round in the Story League, how much did that influence your decision-making here?
So this is going to sound a little bit disappointing, but tailoring to this mission and tailoring to what I thought I could face basically did not come up at all. I'm very fond of the units I'm bringing. I've basically run this exact list for the last year through the last two GHBs and into this one. It's just something I decided on when I started collecting, and it worked out really well for the last two GHBs. I think it's starting to struggle with this one, so I might have to change it up soon. But other than endless spells, all the units have been the exact same. It plays into a lot of missions well. It's basically a shooting castle. It's a battle reg, and then because you can only slot one artillery, I had to slot the other warp lightning cannon as its own drop, which is, I think, my main weakness here. My issue is, one lightning cannon with an engineer isn't enough. Three is too many. Two is the right amount, but there's no way to keep that into a one drop. So I'm kind of stuck hoping I don't go into any one or two drops, because I really like winning deployment and taking the second turn and hoping for that double. So far, it's only happened once, playing many games in this GHB. Everyone seems to be taking like 5-6 drops, taking the Andorian Acolyte Regiment or the Wizard Hunters. So it hasn't been too bad. I wish there was a way for me to improve it while keeping the list the same, but I'm working with what I've got. So pretty much what I've been running is basically all Skyr shooting Skaven. My favorite subfaction. I love the steampunk rats. They are my heart and soul. They're the reason I came to AOS. So we've got my general is an arch warlock with his purple steampunk armor with his 3-up save. He has Shaman of the Chilled Lands as his command trait. His artifact, since we can no longer give Arcane Tome to wizards with this GHB,
I know, it
is having him as a 3 cast was so good, that it really hurts to lose it, but at least if I'm taking second, I can give him Andorian Locust for the extra cast and Unbind. So he takes Esoteric Warp Resonator now, which basically gives him a free Warpstone Spark every turn,
right?
Which he immediately...
For people who don't know what the Sparks do, maybe go over that real quick.
Oh, so at the start of the game, I roll D3 plus 3 Warpstone Sparks for the game. Every turn, I can use them in the magic phase, shooting phase, or combat phase to either buff the character or buff the damage on shooting units around the character. The only unit that benefits from it in this list is the block of Storm Fiends, because it bumps their damage up by 1. The Warp Lightning Cannons don't benefit because they don't shoot normally. He basically gets a free Warpstone token every single turn, which just gets used, or every battle round, which just gets used to buff the shooting. And his spell was More and More Warp Power, which pretty much just gives the Storm Fiends a flat +1/+1 until my next hero phase, which applies an Unleash Hell and any other kind of fighting, shooting that occurs. My other small wizard hero is the Warlock Engineer. You now need him specifically to buff the cannons with the new Battle Tome. You can't use the Bombardier anymore. So his one job is specifically, you babysit the cannons, and occasionally you get teleported somewhere where I need you to be. He has more warp power as well, in case I need him to buff the Storm Fiends if something happens to my general. And then, of course, we have Thankwell, with 4 Flamers and Skitterleap, because he's just so good. He has so much utility. He's a monster if I need to smash terrain. He has so many wounds. He heals. He has a 5-up ward. He lets me double command once per battle round. Even at like 400-something points, he's such a steal. Oh, and if I'm near a Gnawhole or Arcane Terrain, I'm at +4 to cast.
If you had both the Gnawhole and Arcane Terrain.
Yeah, then you're at a +5, and it's just like, all right, I win the magic phase. Take that, Slan. And of course, take him with the 4 Warpfire Projectors. His melee attacks just are not worth it, and you're better off just flaming anything near you at any given time.
Yeah, so for people who don't know how the flamers work, they roll 1 dice for each model in the unit, and there's 4 of them. So you roll 4 dice for each model in the unit, and each 4-up is a mortal wound. And this is a missile weapon, so he can unleash hell with it. And it is brutal against pretty much every army except like Gargants and Stormcast.
Yeah, exactly. It's even against Stormcast.
It's still good.
In my last league game, I also faced Stormcast with a different kind of list, but still, when he can connect with it, like you just die. Like if you have a basic troop unit with 5 models, 20 dice, odds are that wipes the unit exactly, and it's beautiful to see.
Yeah, very useful.
I think the best I've ever had him do was I played against Fire Slayers and got charged by a 20-man Berserker squad and wiped them to the wound on Unleash Hell.
Ooh.
And I explained to the guy exactly what was going to happen, and he didn't believe me. And it was such a feel-good moment. I felt bad for him. I think that basically ended the game there, but I'm still chasing that high there that happened.
Brutal. Well, yeah, between that and the lightning cannons, which do somewhere between 0 and 12 mortal wounds and sometimes kill themselves, it's just a lot of mortal wound output from range.
Yeah, that one a little more swingy, but also worth it. Mm-hmm. If you can get a cheeky Unleash Hell off onto something important.
Oh, and since Thankwell copies commands, you can unleash with him and then unleash with the lightning cannon.
That's basically the crux of my list when I go up against combat armies, is I screen. I try to get you to charge into one specific spot. You're either going to eat Thankwell, a cannon, another cannon, and Storm Fiends. And like you're eating 2 out of those 4 if you charge, because I basically every time I will be saving the double command for that Unleash Hell.
Yeah, it's such scary shooting output when you charge that. And because you can unleash it twice, it's not like you can absorb the unleash with a unit like Aether Wings or something and then charge the Grand Hammers in. Like, you have to think about how you're going to deal with 2 different Unleash Hell. It's really, it's not trivial. It's a really useful thing.
Yeah, it adds another dimension, which it makes my defensive capabilities a lot better. So as much as he takes up a lot of valuable points in the list, he is very much key to getting a lot of stuff happening.
Sweet.
And then as far as our battle line units go, we got three standard units of 20 clan rats, got a champion bell ringer for the extra move, standard bearer for, I don't actually remember what he does. I want to say it has something to do with bravery, but I don't think it's ever come up.
Is that the one that revives models in the battle shock phase?
No, that's just a regular, that's just a rule on their war scroll.
Oh, okay.
I think it's called Seething Swarm. And then six Storm Fiends as my big shooting block. Always take two machine guns, two wind launchers for that 24-inch, no line of sight needed shooting with high rend. And then two melee guys of your choice for flavor, because their job is just take wounds. You die first.
What is your purpose? To die.
Yeah, literally. And then, yeah, to wrap it up, the two lightning cannons and my three Gnawholes.
Sweet.
My grand strat was keep my general alive, which I might end up changing later in this league. I haven't had much luck with it since he tends to be a magic missile when I need him to be, and I throw him into very vulnerable situations. Yeah.
Skitter leaping him up and then trying a blizzard, that can win you the game, but at the same time, it can also fail horribly, and then you just die because there's no way for you to teleport back.
Yeah. Immediately. Or even you get blizzard off and then you roll four ones and do 4d3 mortals to yourself.
Yep, had that happen.
I've seen it happen. And yeah, I was 1990 points. My triumph was indomitable for auto-passing a battle shock, usually on clan rats. And I was two drops, and that's my whole list.
Sweet. Well, before we move on, let me ask you about the loadout you picked for the Arch Warlock in particular. So you went with Shaman of the Chilled Lands. That's the new command trait that teaches you all the spells from the lore of Primal Frost. Why did you pick that over any of the other command traits available? Because there's Master of Magic, there's different Skaven command traits, I assume. Why would you pick Shaman over all of those?
So the Skaven command traits aren't fantastic for Skyr. Unless you're building into very specific things. Like, there is one good one that is pretty much, you make your Doom Wheels go faster. Or there's another decent one that is, Skaven can have hidden weapon teams in their Clan Rat units. But unlike Gloomspite Gitz, who just have better rules than us, where they hide fanatics in their units, and if you wipe the unit, the fanatics pop out, our weapon teams just die with the unit if you wipe the Clan Rats. He has a command trait that basically prevents that from happening if you're really loading up on weapons teams. But there's nothing specifically that worked well for my list. I used to take Master Magic for the free rerolls, and I can also eat a Warpstone Spark in my hero phase to give myself free rerolls on casting and unbinding. But it doesn't really play well into this GHB because of the way primal dice don't interact with rerolls. You get one or the other. So if you do that, you're kind of handicapping yourself on your ability to use them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was going to be my next question. You took the Esoteric Warp Resonator, which gives you a Warpstone Spark every round. But because you're going to get D3 plus 3, that's minimum 4, usually 5. And if all you're using it for is shooting, then that should be enough, right? Like, this artifact that generates an extra 1, is that just so that you have more options to reroll spells?
Yeah, pretty much is just, again, like, the relics are a real struggle for Skyr 2. Like, they don't come in super handy, so that was the best one I could pick. There's the Brass Orb, which is a little funny, because if you do end up connecting with me, I can just say, I throw a holy hand grenade at you, and you're back in your deployment zone somewhere. Which is funny, but it doesn't really accomplish a lot, I feel. So I have that, or take a free Warpstone Spark, and I ended up deciding on the free Spark just because it gives me a bit of flex on where I want to spend them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you can be more aggressive with rerolling, and so you don't have to be conservative with them.
Exactly, or in like a, it didn't come up in this game, but in a nightmare scenario where he is stuck in combat for more than a round, he can eat a spare Spark too and basically buff his melee damage. And hit rolls.
The nightmare scenario. Let's hope it never happens.
Yeah. If I'm in combat, things have gone wrong. Which is a 50-50, really.
You either are or you aren't, right? 50-50.
Exactly. I see you took statistics as well.
All right, let's talk about my list. This is Drop the Hammer. We featured this on Lords of the Storm last week or 2 weeks ago, depending on when you watch this video. This is a list I've been testing out because I like the idea of using Grand Hammers this season, especially with Quester Soulsworn. I think they add a new dimension to the list. And I've been trying to make a really strong version of this list, trying to plug in some holes that I see in this archetype. So we'll go over what's in the list first. We've got a Knight in Cantor, who is my general. He will be casting Lightning Blast every turn just to ping things for D3 Mortal Wounds at somewhere across the table from any range. And sometimes he will be translocated forwards to cast Merciless Blizzard. I want to keep him alive, so that's a risky play. And my grand strategy is Spellcasting Savant, so if I lose him to Casting Blizzard, that's not a really good trade for me, but sometimes that can win you the game, right? Like, it's good to have that in your pocket.
Exactly. Same here.
Yeah, the translocate, especially because the translocate can't be stopped on, like, Skitter Leap or, like, Teclis's Teleport spell from a Wind Mage, I guess, too. Prayers just can't be stopped, so I like this combo in Stormcast, and it's something I want to use more. Even though I don't have High Priest, so I can't reroll the translocation if it rolls a 1 or 2, it's still just a nice thing to have. I'm trying to get away from relying too much on translocation, because every time I need it to work, like if I declare a battle tactic that needs High Priest translocate to work, it always fails. That's the one role that always fails, you know? So trying to get away from that, trying to be less reliant on it.
Mm-hmm.
Rounding out my Acolytes Battalion, I've got a Lord Imperitant with an Arcane Tome. Obviously, you need the Lord Imperitant to make this whole Grand Hammer combo work. He's the unit that allows you to drop more than 7 inches away. And the free command every turn is nice. I will say it's nice. It's not crucial, like you can play without it, but it's nice to have. Probably not worth 160 points, but hey, maybe the Battle Scroll will fix that.
Yeah, he's the one that came with that dog token, right?
Yes.
we'll I love that. Okay, that. We're going to talk about that.
In my Wizard Finders of Antor Battalion, because I thought, look, I've got a lot of units. I've got a lot of units, so I'm just going to take Wizard Finders. I'm going to see how it does, because in our league, we've got a bunch of Soul Blight. We're running a bunch of Wizards. We've got Crocolis. We've got lots of Dracolines. I think every Stormcast player in the league is using Dracolines right now. So
you did this. You and James did this.
Yeah, I'll take credit. That's fine. And now I'm countering. So that's my gambit here, as I'm going to create the meta and then I'm going to counter the meta.
There you go.
So I went Wizard Finders to get +1 attack on the Grand Hammers, bumping them up to 4 attacks. That's a total increase of 9 max damage on 3s and 2s, run 2, which is really nice. And on the Quester Soulsworn, it increases their max damage from 38 to 50, a big old whopping 5-0 on 3s and 3s, run 1. So that's a nice increase. I really like having that. I like the fact that it doesn't require buffing them in the hero phase or anything. So if you just drop them into play and charge them in onto a wizard, you immediately get this bonus. I've been looking forward to using that. And unfortunately, you didn't really give me any wizards to fight. But I mean, we'll talk about that. I don't want to spoil anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Then I had a whole bunch of leftover units, and Stormcast have access to a one drop battalion called the Redemption Brotherhood. I stuck them all in there. I could just have more drops, and that's usually what I would do, but I feel like this archetype in particular needs to get under these greedy Lord Crocolists, who will try to just fish for a double if they can. Anytime they get a double turn, the game's over, because this list can't survive multiple turns of taking D3 Mortal Wounds from Croak in the face. So it can survive one turn, probably, but not two. So making sure Croak never has a double turn is a priority. And there's like 3 or 4 Seraphon players in the league, and there was a good chance I was going to be matched against one. So took that extra Redemption Brotherhood, reduced my drops down.
Yep. I think there's only one Starborn player. I don't think the Coalesce guys are running him, but I did face Starborn on this exact battle plan at a local RTT. The Croak double really, I've never faced it before, and it definitely hurt. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to see why people don't like it.
Yep. Hopefully they do something about it. We'll see. So filling out the rest of my units to pair with the Grand Hammers and the Questers, because they can drop anywhere on the table and then get a pretty reliable 7-inch charge, especially with a reroll, I felt like how I needed to complement that was with a unit of Long Strikes. Using Thunderbolt Volley, they can clear out a screen in the hero phase, which gives me room to drop units into play in the movement phase, which is very, very useful. They're also just a very long-range threat. So when you have the Long Strikes and Lightning Blast just shooting every turn, it's like the opponent has to come to you, but you're so far away that if they start coming towards you, you just drop speed bumps in the way. Like, you're dropping Grand Hammers, you're dropping Questers, dropping Tempesters, all these things drop in, and the time it takes you to clear those out, Long Strikes and Lightning Blast and the Dracolines are just hitting you every single turn.
I think Long Strikes are fantastic. And I gotta say, as someone who also wants to shoot you back, they're one of your few units that really stress me out. Between them and the Tempesters, the ability for you to just shoot my stuff, and I can't really do much about it because either you have 30-inch range or you just teleport near me, it's a rough one.
Yes, with very careful play, long strikes will just dismantle a Skaven army over 4 turns. Even over 2 or 3 turns, honestly. Just this turn, there's a lightning cannon gone. This turn, there's a lightning cannon gone. Next turn, there's a hero gone if I just translocate up.
Exactly.
The nerf to the new version of Lookout, Sir, is definitely impacting their viability this season. But I've just found there's always something useful for them to shoot. And in this style in particular, long range coupled with shooting in the hero phase is just too important to pass up. Like, this style needs to clear space in the hero phase. And we can't really do it reliably with spells, so it's got to come through other means. The Tempesters are in there because I want to be able to score Draconeth Destruction at some point in the game. It's a battle tactic that's pretty important for Stormcast to score. They're also just a really good tanky unit that's also battle line, which can score Let Into the Maelstrom at some point, too. So a lot of this list is their, like, standard Grand Hammer-type list, but it's tailored for this season. It's tailored for this battle plan. Let's jump into deployment. So here's the table. We were using the Florida Terrain Pack, which is something you've played with before. This wasn't your first time using. For people who are unfamiliar, how it works is we assign tokens to all the terrain. So instead of rolling for mystical terrain, it's like, oh, here's a bunch of, you know, damned and deadly terrain that's not going to really impact the game at all. What this terrain pack does is it says, well, the defender gets to just place the tokens, and then the attacker gets to pick which side of the table they want. So the terrain was set up ahead of time. You won the roll-off, I believe, and you chose to be the defender. So what this allowed you to do was to put a number of tokens down. And what you chose to do, as you can see here, you put Arcane in the middle across from each other, and then an impassable piece in the middle. So I like what you did there with the impassable piece, because that means going from left to right across the battlefield becomes very difficult. And especially for both of our armies, once we're committed, you know, once we're out of range of that skitter leap or the translocation, like, we can't rapidly redeploy. So if you can take a commanding position on the pulse, you should be able to leverage that into a really strong,
advantage. And I do like the terrain pack tokens. It was only like my second time using them, so I still am not too experienced with them. Most games I don't play terrain rules. So really, I just opted, I'm like, I want to make this table as balanced as possible while still having stuff that benefits me on either side. So I basically, like, Arcane dead center, because I'm going to benefit from that either way. And then just Inspiring and Sinister just to mess with Bravery a bit. And then I just wanted to make that bell in the middle very funny. So Impassable and Deadly seemed like a good move just to really get in the way. And then, yeah, once we had sides picked out, it went to just placing my gnaw holes and having a fairly balanced table, which made for a fun game.
Yeah, I picked the side that you're seeing on the south here. Obviously, from my perspective, I was taking photos. So that's the side I picked, and you ended up on the north. So I want to take a minute and talk about your gnaw hole placement, because when you first put them down, I thought you were making a mistake. And let me finish this thought before you jump in here. I thought you were making a mistake with your gnaw hole placement, because how I've always seen people play this battle plan is they will play one gnaw hole in their territory and then one gnaw hole in each side. So that no matter which way the pulse goes, they can just teleport to it, right? And that's typical. But the problem, of course, with gnaw holes, especially against Stormcast, is as soon as a unit gets within 3 inches, you can't use it anymore, right?
Exactly.
And so I think you did, and this became more obvious as we played through the game, is you placed one of your gnaw holes near the pulse so that you could just teleport to that one if that ended up being the pulse. And then you placed your other two in your territory so you could just jump your lightning cannons and your storm fiends back and forth as needed. And with a 24-inch threat range after teleporting, that's a huge amount of coverage on the central objectives. Because you deployed your army a little bit on the left, right? Like, you put a lot of your heavier shooting on the left side. If the pulse was on the left, you would have been okay. And if the pulse was on the right, well, then you can teleport units over there. So that's what, after thinking about it, did I get that right? Is that what you were thinking?
Yeah. So that was pretty much the idea, is, And this is something I'm trying to get better with still. I used to deploy my Gnawholes way too aggressively and then, you know, go for that first turn alpha strike. Wouldn't work out a lot. And so what I've realized is I need to try to go second and take the double. But what I need to do in the meantime is I need to make sure that people can't just run up and turn off my Gnawholes. So I try to always keep them in my half of the board, pretty much. I don't want them anywhere near your deployment zone. And I've been messing with this the last few games, having two on my back line, and like you said, to basically redeploy my shooting wherever I want it. And it has come in super clutch most games. Like the last game I had against Stormcast, basically, I don't think any of his hammers touched any of my shooting hammers the entire game because I just kept switching sides wherever he decided to commit. And when it works out, it's really, really good. When it doesn't work out, you're kind of hemmed to your back wall, but that's where my army is usually stuck anyway for the first few turns. So it is... I'm still getting used to it, but I find that's the better play, is to be more conservative with Gnawhole placement. Especially, and like you said, against Stormcast, with all your teleporting, all your fast movers, all your deep strike, you just show up and it's gone in like 2 seconds. So yeah. I really have to, I basically have to account for the fact that versus you, one of them is never going to come up.
Right, right. And that certainly does explain your thinking on your deployment and your first round. So let's go into that. So I started deploying my Knight Relictor. He's certainly within an inch of the arcane terrain. And based on your Gnawhole deployment, I wanted to make sure that I was very far away from you, because I know that everything that comes out of the Gnawhole has a threat range of 24 inches max, right? Either mm-hmm. 24 inches on the lightning cannons or 24 inches on the wind launchers. And I'm very worried about both of those. I would just rather not take any damage. So I put my Knight Relictor nice and safe in the back on arcane terrain. Even though he's not a wizard, he can use heroic willpower to gain an unbind, and then he would have a plus one unbind. So
plus one dispel.
So that could come in handy. That was my first drop, and you responded by putting down your lightning cannon on the left side, I believe. Don't recall if it was the left or the right, because it's symmetrical, so I don't know how important that is.
It was my right side. So yeah, I basically in the top left corner of the screen there, I dropped that cannon basically perpendicular as far back as I could near the Gnawhole.
Right. And being Stormcast, of course, my next drop was in reserve. It was one of the Wizard Finder units. And then you had the rest of your battle regiment. So let's talk about what you were thinking with your deployment. There's a few things you wanted to point out. I know we were talking about before we started recording. So run me through what were your thoughts on this.
So pretty much I did the same thing with the other cannon, far back as far as possible from your lines, right near the other Gnawhole. Thankwall found a little space between the arcane and the Gnawhole there just to give him that sweet, sweet plus five that didn't really mean much for the first turn, but it's nice to have. Storm Fiends I placed within six of the other Gnawhole with both of my characters, the Engineer and the Arch Warlock, so they both get their plus one to cast. And then I deployed two units of Clan Rats, basically one on the left side, one on the right side, and one long line, at least 3 inches. I think they were about 3.5 inches up from the front of their base to the next unit back, just to really avoid your pile-ins. And what's the unit? The Evocator's Lightning, if you decided to YOLO with your Evocats.
Yeah, for people who aren't familiar, Evocators, after attacking, get to pick any enemy unit within 3 inches and just hit them with a lightning blast. And in this league, there's a lot of people using six Evocators. I'm only using three, but it still hurts. And you'd rather not take that damage if you can avoid it.
Yeah, especially into like really valuable units. Like once my Storm Fiends start dropping, the odds they come back are near zero. Unless I get a really lucky rally, which hasn't happened yet. but yeah, so actually, so I basically tried to screen out my front line and my sides. I did make one mistake here that will come up in the first turn. On the top left corner there, I measured out 9 inches from my board corner to the very furthest Clan Rat, so that I thought I had that whole back corner screened off, forgetting about your character with the 7-inch deep strike rule.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side, I had the third unit of Clan Rats just ready to advance and watch, basically screen out the other back corner much better. That one I managed 7 inches. Something new I did try this game, on the advice of one of our mutual friends, was I get very tired of my lightning cannons getting picked off by long strikes. So you, the usual way I would deploy is I would have two cannons together with the engineer and then storm fiends somewhere in the middle on that arcane terrain. But he brought up a very good point that if I want to dodge your long strikes plinking me, I can just put both cannons through the gnaw hole in the middle, skitter leap the warlock engineer between them, and then I have my castle set up out of nowhere to retaliate against you. So I did try that. Didn't really come up just because of the way we're going to see how you deployed. But it is interesting, and I think I'm going to give it another shot in my future games.
Okay.
Just because it's a nice little tricky way to throw people off their guard.
Right. Now, I think the best way to approach dealing with long strikes is to just accept that I am going to shoot something and probably kill one of your cannons, but to try to position so that you punish me for it. You know, so like if I drop in and kill the lightning cannon, you will have a unit that can teleport to that gnaw hole and shoot them back. Right. That that should probably be the way to play around it. And that unit should probably be the storm fiends. But now that I say that, the storm fiend shooting going into the long strikes is not ideal. 6 wounds max on that unit. You know, it's not.
Oh, yeah, I know. It is still handy to counter shoot them with the wind launchers, though, when possible.
Because,
you know, even if you roll average, you know, you will kill them with a few extra wounds spilled, but it's not too much overkill. And yeah. Then you can throw the rattling guns into something closer range.
Right. I also like how you've positioned your heroes more than 3 inches from the front line, especially your foot heroes there. That way I can't just drop in Tempesters and shoot at them immediately because of Lookout Sir preventing them. I'm not able to get within 12 inches, so I just can't do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Well, let's talk about the first thing I noticed with your deployment. This was my thought. These red lines represent the Skaven kill zone. knowing that the Storm Fiends can move 6 inches and then shoot 24, knowing that everything that comes out of the gnaw hole is 24 inches, I just set up these dice all around my deployment and said, well, if anything, you know, everything behind these dice is safe. It's not taking any damage turn one. There's nothing you can do except for, you know, skitter leap into a blizzard, and I've got a dispel scroll ready for that just in case. So it should be the case that if I stay behind this black line here of dice, I should be okay.
Exactly. It's not a big area. It's all you got.
Right. And I squeezed this to the max. Let's see what my deployment looked like. I put some liberators on the front line there so that I could try to screen out a teleport into a blizzard, because that spell's only 12-inch range. If I have my units more than 3 inches off the front line, you can't teleport and then blizzard them. I was able to do that with my long strikes. I wasn't able to do it on the right side with my Dracolines, but I figure a blizzard, you know, I've still got that dispel scroll. It's not like the biggest threat in the world. So I could probably do something there. Can't have it all with deployment, unfortunately. Yeah, as you mentioned, you left not enough room for a 7-inch drop in the bottom, in the top right, but you did leave enough room for a 7-inch drop in the top left.
Yep, and that was 100% a mistake on my part. It's something I easily could have fixed just by shifting some rats over, but it completely escaped my mind during deployment.
Right, and because this is, you know, a more competitive game, because it's a store league, there's an element of competition involved. I didn't notice the mistake, honestly, until it came to it, and I already finished deploying. But since it is a competitive game, it's not the kind of thing I would have mentioned, you know? Mistakes got to be... You know, you got to eat your mistakes in a competitive game, so...
Yeah.
What else can I mention off this deployment? I made sure to deploy my long strikes within 30 inches of one of the front units of Clan Rats, keeping them more than 30 inches out of that kill zone, but within 30 inches so that I could use Thunderbolt Volley and start killing rats anytime. In particular, you'll notice there's that seam where one unit starts and the other unit ends, based off the movement trays. So there was a possibility to shoot at two different units there.
Is that right? Yeah.
No, never mind. The gray base is on the right side. That's where the unit started.
Okay, yeah, right down the middle. The gray bases on the arcane terrain, and everything to the right is one unit, and then everything to the left is the other unit.
Mm-hmm. So I made sure to keep all my wizards out of 30 inches. I knew that I couldn't stop your casting unless I wanted to use my Dispel Scroll, and it's not really worth on round one on this battle plan, because this is not about round one. This is not even about the 1-2 double. This is about the round two, round three, right? That's what defines this battle plan. So I could let you get a Mystic Shield off. I wasn't too worried about it. I didn't need to aggressively deploy forwards. If you force me to go first, I could score Magical Dominance here, have a very easy first turn, pick off some Clan Rats, position, block your Gnawhole. Like, I was really expecting you to make me go first. Just in case I positioned so that if you went first, I would take no damage, and then I was prepared to go first. So I think I was covered either way with this deployment.
Originally, I was going to make you take first, because like I said, my list thrives on the double, and especially it's kind of a glass hammer. It can't really survive a double against high damage armies like all your Grand Hammers. But then after we had both deployed, we realized my mistake in the corner, and I was kind of very stressed about three Grand Hammers coming in and charging one of my cannons and probably piling into, depending on their charge, more rats or maybe even a character nearby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely could have been possible. Well, it was a bit of a gamble. Like, if I commit the Grand Hammers into that corner, that's where they are for the rest of the game. And you could probably unleash hell with the cannon as they're charging in, and that could just kill them all. They're only 9 wounds, right? So
yeah, that's
a lot of them. So it was a calculated risk, I suppose.
Well, but with the way I deployed, with my engineer was not within 3 inches of the cannon, so best I could have done was 6 mortals.
Okay.
So you would have connected no matter what if you made the charge.
Right, and the charge mortal wounds, maybe they swing high and they just kill it before, you know, before that happens, especially with the landing impact mortal wounds too.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's a fair decision. You were also out of range from Magical Dominance, so this worked. Either one of us could have gone first and had a good traverse turn. So you did choose to go first, after all. And here we took a photo at the end of your turn. It was not very eventful because I deployed everything out of your kill zone. All you ended up doing was casting a few spells. I believe you got Mystic Shield off on the Storm Fiends. You got more and more Warp Power. You were actually curious if you should even bother casting more and more Warp Power, because it does D3 mortal wounds to you at the start of your next turn. So mm-hmm. why did you end up casting it? I think we had a discussion about this during the game.
So at first I wasn't going to, and yeah, so same thing for me here. Going into turn one, I went for Magical Dominance because you were completely out of Unbind range. And I have +1 to +5 to cast on any of my characters, so it's a pretty easy tactic to get. I think all of my spells went off. I got a Mystic Shield off on the Storm Fiends, just in case you decided to, like, translocate your long strikes and shoot straight into them, because the mortals chew through them so easy. And, you know, I wanted to protect myself from the other damage. And then, yeah, I wasn't going to do more and more Warp Power, but then I was concerned that since I had gone first, if you got the double and tried to, like, connect with me hard with all your hammers, that I would be able to unleash hell with the +1/+1. Because it is quite devastating when you're ignoring the negative modifiers on unleash mm-hmm. with all that shooting. And the +1 to wound, too. So wounding on 2s on everything is a huge difference.
Yeah.
And
you do take D3 mortal wounds, but it's not like that's even going to kill half a Storm Fiend at worst, right? Because you just put the wounds on one of the melee guys who has 7 wounds, and like it's not even
exactly
a problem.
At the start of the game, I thought, yeah, it's a risk worth taking. I'll take a few wounds off my guys, but just to be prepared if you decide to be aggressive was a much smarter choice.
It was certainly something that I considered during my turn later, when I was like, oh, I don't know if I want to charge into them. Even if I get the double, +1/+1 Storm Fiends really hurt. So it wasn't even the right time to be aggressive, but it took the option away, certainly. Like, it made it less appealing.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about this movement here. What were you trying to accomplish here? Especially with this conga line on the right side that's facing away from the battle.
Hey, listen, they were watching the flanks, okay? It's important. Stormcast can come from anywhere.
Literally watching the flanks.
Yeah. So basically, in the top left there, you can see I shifted my Clan Rat unit to basically alleviate the deployment mistake, protect myself from the Grand Hammers coming in that corner. I just shifted my front line up and the rest of my units, so basically I maintained the 3-inch gap. And I shifted my cannons and Thankwell and Storm Fiends and characters around. I didn't commit to teleporting anything through any Gnawholes, just because you were still outside of range, there was no point to committing any of my resources. Turn one in the hero phase and the movement phase, against a lot of armies, this would be the time where I would Skitterleap my Arch Warlock, go for a Blizzard or an Aether Void or his Warp Lightning Storm. And I gotta admit, you seem like it's not a big deal, but that auto dispel on the Encanter is such a shutdown of any kind of aggression.
Yeah. It's a huge deal. I'm not gonna ever downplay it. Like, we call the Knight Encanter like an S tier unit, the best unit in the Stormcast book. Every list has one, sometimes two. Like, shutting down that one crucial spell, if all that does is buy you a turn of non-aggression, he's paid for his points so much over.
Yeah, exactly. Because, like, literally, and see, that's another reason I deployed my Gnawholes conservatively, because if I thought I could go for that first turn play, I'd throw one up close to your lines.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. Then he could pop out, let out a bunch of endless spells, do a bunch of damage, and then hop back on my turn. And if I lose that Gnawhole, it's whatever, but I definitely did not deploy that way because I knew that you had that up your sleeve and there was just no point to committing just for you to go, oh, no, it doesn't happen.
Yeah, yeah. So especially while the Dispel Scroll's active, you have to, I don't know, you have to bait it out at some point, right? I haven't played that much against it because whenever I play against Stormcast that are using a Knight Encantor, I'm either playing Seraphon and I'm out of Unbinding range anyway, or I'm just playing Stormcast and I don't care if any of my spells get unbound. Like, nothing's crucial, so... I'm not sure how Magic armies deal with it yet.
If you're playing Seraphon, you just let them dispel one of your casts and then go, LOL, I have seven more casts. Yeah. It doesn't matter.
you haven't done anything, really.
Yeah. And you, even if it gets unbound, you still get the cosmic power points, right?
No, it has to be successfully cast and not unbound, I believe.
Oh, okay. So, oh no, you lose 1 point that you'll get next turn. You're fine when you unbind one of theirs. And then, yeah, in the top right corner there, I basically auto-ran the rats 12 inches up to secure that objective for the 1 point I could score this turn. And I wasn't going to move them up that far, but then I realized if I did, I could at least keep you from deep striking on the objective by being on the center.
Yeah, it's perfect, because that's exactly what I was going to do, was I was going to drop Vanquishers. Like, because at first you just put them on the lip of the objective. I'm like, oh, great, I'll just drop in and take it. I don't even have to make the charge. I don't have to move anything up. I can just stay exactly where I am. Yeah, but you saw that and you forced my hand, which was good.
Yeah, so I realized that as I was moving. So I was like, I guess I might have to really go ham with a unit of Clan Rats early. So they risked it for the biscuit to take that objective.
Okay,
well, and that was basically my whole turn one.
Yeah,
nothing really accomplished.
Easy turn. Didn't even have to use any of the primal dice we got. We had a lot of primal dice this round, right? We rolled.
I think we got. I got the four, and you got the extra one from your Endorian acolytes. So yeah. We had like nine primals floating around and nothing to do with them.
Yeah, we both stayed out of unbinding range, which was crazy. Okay, so that was exactly what you need to do, I think, on this battle plan. Is you take a very slow turn. You don't commit one way or the other. You leave yourself open in case the pulse is on one side. You don't want to be caught on the other side, and then you just lose tactically, right? Like, you can't gain the ground back fast enough and you fall behind on points.
Mm-hmm.
And you left yourself pretty well guarded. There was no obvious point where I wanted to be aggressive here. Like, yeah, maybe I could teleport my long strikes forward and shoot the cannon, but then your Storm Fiends teleport forwards and shoot my long strikes. And is that trade worth it to me? Like, in terms of points, no. I'd lose 230. You'd lose, what are they, 150, I think? But I need... Wow. I need those long
strikes. 230 points?
Yes, they are.
Wow, that is more than I thought. Okay.
Yep. It costs the same as Dracolene's almost. It's crazy.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I feel better about taking more Dracolene's in that case.
Well, you need both kinds with Stormcast. Mm-hmm. You gotta play combined arms. So yeah, you got the tactic. It was a nice, easy magical dominance. No models were slain, but that's okay, because this is Geomantic Pulse. You don't really need to do much round one.
Yep.
All right, let's take a look at my turn here. I also decided to do magical dominance because I had some wizards out of unbinding range. I believe my Encantor, my Dracolines, and my Imperitant were all out. I managed to cast Mystic Shield and Power, and I think that was it. I don't remember the third spell. Oh, I was waffling here. So we had... I had five primal dice, and I remember talking to you. I'm like, oh,
You almost did the fun play.
Okay, well...
And it would have... I think it would have been awesome. I think you should have done it just because it would have been better for me.
So the fun play is teleport my Knight and Cantor to the right side, out of range of Thankful's Unbinding, so I could just cast whatever spell I wanted, and still within 12 inches of that pack of clan rats. And what that would do is it would allow me, assuming I cast the spell, and with five primals, I probably would, unless I primal miscast and died, which is a risk, which is probably why I didn't do it. But yeah, if I cleared off those clan rats, I could then just drop my vanquishers onto your gnaw hole behind the line of sight, and you just, that gnaw hole was done, and the lightning cannon couldn't do anything about it, you know? So that was a play I was considering because I had so many primal dice. That was the only reason I even thought about it, because casting on a 12 is usually not good enough. But I decided not to do it because ultimately I needed that dispel scroll protecting the rest of my army. And if my Knight and Cantor was on the right side, it would have been very easy for you to be anywhere in the middle of the battlefield or on the left side and teleport into a pendulum or teleport into a blizzard. And then suddenly I've lost a bunch of key units. And that would have been devastating. So I decided not to do the fun play because this was a more competitive minded game, right? I decided to do the safer, less interesting play.
Yep. Especially like you said, like on my turn, that probably would have been a good moment for me to teleport basically to the left of your Dracolines and line up an Aether Void to hit like 3 to 4 units with its 16 inch range.
Yep.
Like it would have been fantastic.
Yep, and that's just the...
Plus the possible blizzard.
The power of that dispel scroll is just keeping me alive. So the longer I hold on to it, the better. That means your wizards can't really engage properly. They can't get good threat ranges. So the longer I hold on to it, the better. What I ended up doing instead of the fun play is I just scored magical dominance. I knew I needed to control at least one objective, and I didn't want to commit anything useful this match, right? I couldn't just drop vanquishers on there. Like, probably my vanquishers would charge in and kill a bunch of clan rats and take that objective. But what if the charge fails? Because my first charge of the game always fails. That's like an iron rule of this game. So I dropped my vanquishers on the right side, ready to charge in the clan rats. And just in case, I moved up my liberators. I ran 6 to get them onto the objective. And just to make sure I had one objective so I could score the max amount. There are some very specific ranges I kept in mind when I finished my movement here. First off, I made sure my liberators were on the objective, but more than 18 inches away from that front row of Storm Fiends. Now, the Storm Fiends have a 6-inch move and a 12-inch rattling gun, and that would just obliterate the liberators. There's just that's just too much volume fire. They would just be wiped out. So
yeah, that would be 6d6 shots, 2s and 2s, rend 1, 2 damage. So each one going through is a dead lib.
Yep, it's Yeah, I didn't want to let you own the libs, so I make your word for it. The wind launchers, of course, I can't stay out of range of them and contest the objective, but I'm okay with sacrificing this pawn in order to force you to move up, and then I can pounce on you. Another important range measured here is the 30-inch gap from the second row of Storm Fiends, which had the wind launchers, and the Dracolines. Now, this is super important because I don't want my Dracolines taking a bunch of Ren 3 shots, right? This is the best target for you to shoot, right? There's nothing else on the table that you can shoot that is better than the Dracolines, and they can't charge in and do any significant damage, so why would I risk them right now? I can just hold them back, keep them just out of your range, and be able to react properly in round 2.
Exactly, and I think you also measured the 30 inches from the gnaw hole and from the other cannon just to make sure that you had... Because, again, either of them could have teleported and been at you that way.
Yep, exactly. So the 30 inches from the second... If they were on the front row, I would have had to be even further back. But because you had the wind launchers in the second row, which makes sense, you want the shorter gun up front, you know? So that explains the movements there. And the last things I want to point out here are the lookout surplacements. Now, these frustrated you to no end, I think.
I sincerely think that should be FAQ'd. I think having a model that is basically a token but counts as a model for some reason for Lookout Sir is silly. I'm going to leave it at silly.
So Lookout Sir is if your hero is within 3 inches of a unit with 3 or more models, which both the Dracolines and the Long Strikes count towards this, that hero can't be shot unless the enemy is within 12 inches. Now, because the Skaven player in this case, because you couldn't just get in within 12 inches, there's nothing you could have done to get your units within 12. These heroes are basically immune to shooting as long as they're standing near one of these units. And because the Lord Imperitant's Griffhound counts as part of the same model. It's like treated as a single model for all rule purposes. My Lord Imperitant can stick out as far as he is, and then the Hound can be where he is and still get the whole unit counts for Lookout Sir. And if you're looking at this, especially if you're looking at it from your perspective, Sarah, there's just no way this makes sense. Like, how are the long strikes in the back bodyguarding a dog and that's stopping the hero from being shot? Like, this rule needs to change. It's just not intuitive at all.
And yeah, actually, I did want to chime in on that, because what you were saying earlier about lookouts are really messing with long strikes for sniping characters. I feel the exact same way about my Storm Fiends. They're basically their number one use case the last two, or before Lookout Sir got introduced this year, was like first turn or second turn, no matter what, one of your foot characters is dying to a wind launcher. Like, either if you are not hugging your back lines like you were in this game, I would just target you, not needing line of sight, go ahead, hide behind terrain, and I would kill your buffing wizard or your priest or whatever character you needed to buff up your hammers. And I really don't like the lookout sir change. Or I don't like the rule in general. I think it makes foot characters too strong.
It certainly makes them too safe and too durable throughout the whole game, right? If it was like on the first turn 12 inches, next turn 18 inches, then, you know, whatever, I think that would be okay. Like, at some point you can just shoot them freely. Maybe it causes it, call it like the fog of war or something. But it's just,
or like, as the battle goes on, you can clearly see who is leading.
Yeah, some kind of change needs to happen, because as it is now, it's not an intuitive rule. Like, you can see in this photo, this doesn't make sense why it's working the way it is. And it's also just making some heroes too easy, too difficult to kill, I should say.
Mm-hmm. And like, I've been on the receiving end of it too. Like, in previous GHBs, having my engineer sniped out by shooting or like Seraphon abilities. And it's like, yeah, that makes sense. I have to deploy him safely out of line of sight or away from terrain or whatever the rule is to keep him alive and in the game. But now it's just kind of like, nope, I just plop him near my Storm Fiends and he will never die.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Hopefully that'll change soon.
Mm-hmm.
So other things to mention, I dropped Vanquishers on the right side. The reason I dropped them on the right side and not in the middle, there's two main reasons. First off, if you wanted to shoot them with the lightning cannon, you'd be forced to teleport the lightning cannon over, which would allow me to then next turn get my long strikes in range to shoot it freely without taking any kind of risk in doing so. But I'm also setting up for surround and destroy on turn two. My Aether Wings are not in this photo. They're off to the left side. They are setting up for surround and destroy as well. They're going to run up the left flank and provide plus one hit to whatever. You know, if the pulse is there, great. If not, they can get into the middle of the board pretty easily. I was hoping the Vanquishers would charge in, kill a bunch of clan rats, pile in towards the Gnawhole and disable it. But that didn't work. All plans have to be adaptable, you know. And my long strikes, they didn't really do much this turn. I just translocated them so that they could shoot at the clan rats on the right side. I had considered shooting the clan rats on the Gnawhole. I opted to shoot the ones in front of Thankwell instead. And that turned out to be a good idea going into round two. And we can talk about that.
if you had shot the clan rats off to the side, I would have just pulled from the front anyway, kind of ruining your plan there.
Exactly.
So it definitely didn't make sense. And then I would just literally, with all the CP from turn one, inspiring presence, D3 comeback. Like, it's how much are you really accomplishing by shooting that unit?
Not much at all. Whereas if I start shooting at the screens in front of your castle, well, that starts giving me more options. For my drop play style that I'm trying to do here. All right, so let's talk about round two. You won the dice roll, and you opted not to give me a double turn and to go first. So I guess we can talk about that first. Why did you decide to go first, given the board state and this? Because this gave me control of choosing where the objective went, right? Where the pulse activated. So what was your thought process?
My thought process really was just that, with how much damage your long strikes had done to that screen in front of Thankwall, I thought for sure if you had the double, I was about to see like three Grand Hammers and four Tempesters go straight into him, no problem. And I think if I had let you drop your Grand Hammers there, I think their mortal wounds probably could have hit like four different units, like Thankwall and the cannon and both units of Clan Rats around there. So I think that would have been problematic for me. And I didn't really like the idea that you would be able to get so much into basically my main caster, which is, you know, maybe I should have pulled the clan rats differently, but you did kill literally half the unit. So it was a tough choice to make. And honestly, I didn't really care too much about you deciding on the pulse. Because again, I have my Nahul set up. I think I was in a good position for you to pick either one.
Hmm. Yeah, because if I had picked the right one here, you would have just teleported units onto it, and you would have been fine. Because my Vanquishers failed the charge. Again, that failed Vanquisher charge really swung the tempo of the game in a lot of ways. A lot of decision-making came down as a result of that failed charge.
Yeah, like, if you had picked that side, I would have shifted back. I would have held that objective. I would have shifted my screens over to that side of the field. Vanquil on a cannon would have moved up. Storm Fiends would have probably teleported into my back corner there, kill some Vanquishers, and that would have been a really nicely castled up turn to leave your Liberators and Dracolines sitting on the other side of the board.
Mm-hmm. So those are all good reasons to take the first turn. Let's talk through the turn, and then we can see if it was the right decision. Because obviously, when you take the turn, you're giving me the chance to double you in round 2 to 3, right? Like, you're taking that risk. What you're usually going to do with a position like this is say, I'm going to do so much damage to you that even if you take a double going into the next round, I'll still be okay. Like, that's usually the posture you need to take when you make a decision like that.
Mm-hmm.
Talk me through your second round. How did it go?
So the second round was really just a lot more of the first round, where it was, how can I maximize my scoring before this all goes up in smoke? With a lot of hammers still sitting in Deep Strike waiting to hit me. So I basically, opposite of what we just said, you made it the left side of the board for holding the objective. So I basically shifted my cannons around through the Gnawholes. Thankwell walked his 10 inches over, stayed near the arcane terrain for a measly +4 to cast.
Ugh, going how into unfortunate. Your turn.
Yeah, I know. What a loser. Shifted my screens around, one unit moved up and tagged the pulse, one unit, you only had 4 liberators, I think, touching the objective, so I just moved 5 rats onto it with my other unit, even though I was pretty sure I was gonna wipe the liberators, didn't happen.
Well, let's talk about why exactly that happened, how that went down. So from what I remember, and this was a game we played a week ago, so who knows what I remember, you shot at it with a cannon. You rolled like a 5, right?
So I didn't overcharge any cannons,
yeah,
because that would be really stupid going into liberators of all things, especially when they're sitting with a nice little 6-up ward that could spike. So I just did the possible 6 mortal wounds. I think I rolled like a 5 first and then a 6. Yeah. Like it was not good. I think I managed to kill like one with both cannons, and then I shot my Storm Fiends and I managed to kill another one because, like you said, you were on your plus. How did you get the +3 save? It was Mystic Shield, all out defense, and
they just get +1 because they're liberators.
Oh, okay.
So they're a 4-up with +1 all the time.
Oh, right. They're a 4-up base and then they get +1 from the shields.
Yeah. All right. So how I remember this shooting going is you shot either the cannon. It was the cannon first, and that didn't roll very well. So you're like, okay, I guess I have to dedicate the wind launchers into them. At least you didn't say this, but I'm thinking this is what's happening. And because I have +3 save, the wind launchers like basically bounced off, right? And you killed one liberator and you wounded one. And then I still had my 4 models on the objective, and that you wanted to get rid of at least one of them so you could just walk some rats onto it, right? And then you decide, okay, I have to commit the second cannon now. To be fair, I did spike a bit on 6-up wards. So it forced you to dedicate the second cannon, which then was able to kill off another one.
Mm-hmm. Which to be fair, the cannon didn't really have much else to shoot. But it still sucked. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow, a 5-man, 10-wound unit and like how many, like 800 points of shooting going into it and can't do anything.
If I was in range of those rattling guns, those liberators would have been gone. Those cannons would have been teleporting around and shooting other stuff. Like the Vanquishers probably would have been gone, and that would have destroyed my tactic. You know, like so many decisions, so many things come down.
Honestly, Yeah, like, and you were talking about this before in the last turn, and that's something I probably could have done better, is I, when I was shifting up, I wanted to be conservative, but if I had just towed in so that objective was wholly within 18, so that, like, it was a kill zone for the Rattling guns, even if you just towed it, I probably should have done that. But then you could have just run, like, Aether Wings onto a different objective.
Yeah, I did get a translocate off. That's always an option. I could have just translocated the liberators onto the objective mark number four there, right? Because we marked them based on the turns. They were going to be the pulse.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, plus three save really, really hurts. It turns gas grenades into rubber balls.
Yeah, especially when you have a six up ward that you spike too. So that
Yeah.
after failing the Vanquisher charge, which is, one of the most reliable things, it's basically like rolling a two up, then you swing low and then you swing high. That's just how this game goes.
Yeah, exactly. So I just consolidated my my army around the middle and the left side there. I basically abandoned that gnawhole. I said, you can have fun with it, have a good time. I think I rallied some rats back. I left that one cannon out in the open just because it was within range of Tankwall to do the double unleash hell, so that if you charge there and then charge somewhere else, I'd still be able to get two shots off. And it's like, if you want to pick off that one cannon with a hammer, sure, go for it. You're about to get hit by all my other units. So I was okay with leaving that corner open with what I had to work with. And yeah, that was pretty much my turn. Nothing killed. My battle tactic was intimidate. So out of my nine units, I had to have five outside of my deployment zone, which I just barely managed by towing up Thankwall, my 2 foot characters, and two units of clan rats in the front. And that scored me holding all the points, that scored me the max six for the turn.
Yeah, Intimidate the Invaders is against a drop hammer list like this, like there's Grand Hammers coming in. Trying to score that battle tactic leaves tiny little pockets in your back line. Like you can probably see make one out here between the Storm Fiends and the Lightning Cannon. I could have dropped Grand Hammers back there. Now that's a good way to just have them die to unleash hell, but that's just kind of a risk that happens when you try to score that battle tactic against this particular style of list. Yeah, you took a very passive turn, which isn't the worst thing to do, especially when you're coming up against a potential double turn here, right? Because you have to assume I'm going to get two turns in a row, right? That's the thinking you have to do is like, okay, well, how do I mitigate that damage? And it looks like you even put your heroes up in front of your Storm Fiends, like to just show how much you want to keep those Storm Fiends alive. You're willing to screen with your general because the Storm Fiends are what's going to win this
No.
game for you.
Yeah, it wasn't so much as that, it is the battle tactic, because as we've discussed, as a Skaven player, I don't have a lot I can do, so I gotta get the ones that I can.
Okay, so
Like,
it was just forcing you into that situation.
pretty much, I was basically stuck in basically that kind of play. I much would have preferred the Arch Warlock to be right between those Storm Fiends and the Gnawhole, very nicely protected.
Yeah, but cannon only moves 3 inches, and you want him to shoot with it, so that's unfortunate. Okay, let me out.
Because with Skaven, it's literally, I think in this GHB, I have Magical Mayhem, Magical Dominance, Intimidate, and Surround and Destroy. And then Reprisal if my general dies, which doesn't, if he's dying, I've already lost my grand strat, so it's a rough one. So that's all I've got to work with. So I Intimidate was the only one I could really get here, with those Vanquishers breathing down my neck on that side. I didn't want to throw away a whole unit of clan rats for it. And yeah, that's what I had to go with.
Fair. So let me ask you about your lightning cannon, because one of these lightning cannons could have teleported to the right gnawhole and blasted the Vanquishers. Out of curiosity, why didn't you do that play?
Because it wouldn't have done anything. Because if I'm teleporting a cannon over there, I would need to first Skitterleap my engineer over there, which you would then be able to, I'm pretty sure, because I've moved up, you would have been able to auto dispel at that point, which I knew Skitterleap was something you had an eye out for.
Yes, I'm very concerned with any teleporting that my opponent is trying to do. I like having a very predictable game. I like fixed threat ranges. So I tend to focus on getting rid of things that can drastically change those variables, like a teleport spell.
Yeah, so if, like, it would have hinged on a Skitterleap first, which if you block it, okay, I move a cannon over, it's doing a max of 6 wounds, which is, considering you were near an objective, let's say that's 2, you roll 1 ward, that's 2.5 dead vanquishers. You're still getting that surround and destroy battle tactic.
Yeah, I guess one cannon wouldn't be enough on its own.
Yeah, unless I, like, hard committed and threw my Storm Fiends there, which is then, like, okay, cool, I just threw away 800 points.
And they're not on the pulse.
Yeah, and yeah, the pulse is on the other side of the board, and it's not the best move.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, I was just curious about that. So, 6-point turn, which is the max you can do, minimal investment, ready for that double turn. Seems like a good setup. You're either going to do tons of damage with this, or you're going to try to play very defensively, and you went for the defensive play.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's talk about my round two. And this is pretty meticulous, so strap in, guys. I had to do a lot of planning here, and I appreciated your patience when I was thinking through my whole turn, because there were a number of things I needed to do. First off, I needed to score Surround and Destroy, and I had the Aether Wings, Liberators, and Vanguard Raptors on the back line there. Everything was in place to do it. Great. I also wanted my Aether Wings, if possible, if they ran far enough, to get within range of the Warp Lightning Cannon so that my Long Strikes could shoot at it. Because there was a very small spot where I could fit that would be able to be within 30 inches of that Lightning Cannon, but more than 30 inches away from the Wind Launchers. Right. And as we discussed, 6-inch move, 24-inch range. I'd rather you not shoot my Long Strikes. I'd rather have them alive every single round this game, shooting key pieces off the board every turn. Mm-hmm. And I managed to find a very particular spot that was wholly within 6 of the board edge, within range to shoot the Warp Lightning Cannon, and with out of range of the Wind Launchers. So great. That's one thing I want to do. I want to score Surround and Destroy. I want to kill both of those Lightning Cannons. How am I going to do it? Well, one of the problems with this play is that because I'm just in range, if you were to redeploy that Lightning Cannon, my whole plan goes out the window, right? So I needed to make sure that I baited out a redeploy from you, and I needed to make sure that any move I made wasn't within 9 inches of that cannon until the redeploy was used. So that's multiple goals already here, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Next up, I knew I needed to commit my Dracolines, because if I got a double here, the game was over. So I wanted to set myself up for a position where I could charge into your screen, and because there is a hole in your screen there, I can charge that angle, pile in past it, and then kill everything behind it, while also locking down Thankwell and the Storm Fiend so that they had to shoot the Dracolines and spend a turn cleaning that up. Mm-hmm. So that seemed like too much for me to pass up with a unit of Dracolines. So that was my plan. So how do I make this easier? Well, one of the things I can do is wipe out that screen using Thunderbolt Volley, right? I'll probably do somewhere like 8 damage on average with Thunderbolt Volley. That should get rid of that screen of, I think, 10 rats at the time, right?
Yeah.
And because I can use this in the hero phase, this is done before I commit any movement, any unit positioning, any drops, anything. So that seemed like a good idea. After doing it, I didn't actually kill enough rats. You still had a bunch of rats alive. So I had to think, well, I need that redeploy to happen. So how do I force that to happen? I can move the Aether Wings up, and your clan rats on the left side can force that. Or I can move my Liberators up to your screen more than 9 inches away from your cannon and then try to force the redeploy there. So I had multiple options for baiting out a redeploy. Then I knew that if you redeployed the clan rats, you could just block that hole. Like maybe you noticed that hole in your lines there. And so I needed the questors to be able to charge in, kill that unit, which would allow the evocators then to get in into that angle, as I discussed before. And the last thing was, what am I going to do with my Tempestors? Because this is round two of the pulse, I need to commit most of my resources. Like, I wanted to hold something back. I was either going to drop in the Questers or the Grand Hammers. I decided I'm going to drop in Questers this turn because I want the high unit count in case this maneuver doesn't work. I want to make sure I have the highest body count possible on objective number mark number two. And then next turn, if in case I don't win a double, I wanted more body count on objective number three. Because I feel like body count's going to really matter here, because your Storm Fiends only count as 2, whereas my Questers count as 3 each. So I decided that they would be the drop this turn.
Mm-hmm.
Which leaves my Tempestors. Well, where do I put them? Given how heavily you went on the left side, if I put my Tempestors on the middle right objective, worst case scenario, you get the pulse, you get the left one, I still have my Tempestors holding the right one and denying you a max score. And then when they drop in, they can shoot the other Lightning Cannon. fulfilling all the criteria that I wanted this turn, which is to kill lightning cannons, max score, and try to pin you down. And that's a very ambitious plan, but because we both had very reserved round one and you had a reserved round two, I felt like this was the time to commit these resources. And I still had a little bit in the back pocket, right? I had my grain hammers. They haven't even come into play yet. How much of this were you able to predict, and how much counterplay do you think you had at the time? And knowing now, is there anything you could have done differently that could have helped you?
Most of this I did see coming. I mean, at the time, Thunderbolt volleying my clan rats surprised me. But I understand why you did it. I thought you would have saved it for possibly another turn. Or because you can translocate and then volley, right?
Correct, yes.
I thought you honestly would have just translocated them up and then double-tapped the cannon.
That's usually what I would have done, but I think I ended this turn more than 9 inches away, so I couldn't translocate them. They had to just block.
Okay. Yeah,
it was a mistake in my positioning in round one.
Mm-hmm. Because, I wasn't expecting a Thunderbolt volley wasted on clan rats. I think the main thing that surprised me was the Tempesters coming down on that side. Okay. I expected you just to deploy all on the left there and just drop all your hammers in my face and make your 7 or 9 inch charges. Because the Tempesters, you don't really care about them making the charge. You just want them to shoot and clear up anything that's in front.
Yeah, my initial plan with them was to drop them on the left side and then kind of just do like a scouring path across the battlefield. But then there was that damn impassable terrain that you put down in the middle. And I realized plan didn't work.
there's a thought process there. It wasn't just for the kicks.
Yep. So let's see how all of this turned out. Did I make all of these goals? Well, I did manage to roll high enough run on my Aether Wings. They got within 12 inches of the Lightning Cannon. I was able to move my Long Strikes over and destroy it. I baited out the redeploy on the Clan Rats with the Liberators, I believe. And you filled the gap, which was good. You also moved more models onto the Pulse, which forced me to drop my Questers on that side. I would have preferred to drop my Questers more towards the objective mark number 3. Because that would have been the Pulse next turn, and I'm trying to get as many models on it as possible, right?
Yeah, that was, so I did know the hole was there. I basically, as soon as you moved your Aether Wings up, I used a redeploy. I think I rolled like something decent, like a 4. I closed that hole, and I also stole back that objective because I realized I had only put 2 or 3 guys on it, and you moved 3 Aether Wings on it, so I needed at least 4.
Yeah.
I was just hoping, you know, maybe he'll whiff his charges. Maybe he'll do really poorly on shooting. No such luck. Your Thunderbolt volley and your shooting phase with your long strikes went well. Cannon blew up. Actually, surprisingly, the other cannon survived your Tempesters.
Yeah. Well, that's because I got greedy and I split my
and
shots.
I put
2 into Thankwell and 2 into the cannon. I thought 2 Tempesters would kill a cannon. I've learned my lesson. Minimum 3 every time. It has to die, right?
Yep.
Every turn it's not dead, it's doing 6 mortal wounds back to me.
People always, I don't think this was your thought process, but the amount of people who throw like pot shots at the cannon and then don't realize like, no, it's 4 up save base. Like if I AOD, odds are you're not doing anything. Like you have the mortals with the Tempesters that I think did most of your wounds, but against like most shooting is like, no, I can shrug it off, and then if I don't overcharge, I can make sure that cannon stays in the game.
Yeah, yeah, it was a low roll as well. I remember picking up the dice, there was so many ones on the hits and 2s on the wounds, it was crazy. But that's because I split the shots, right? There was no need to do that. I did fail the charge on the Tempesters, which is fine, I wasn't relying on it, that wasn't part of my plan.
That wasn't huge, was...
Questers got in, they cleared out the rats. Dracolines managed to finish a charge. Now I specifically finished my charge outside of 3 inches of Thankwell to make sure that he couldn't stomp me or roar me or anything, and outside of range of 6 inches to unleash with Thankwell and the Storm Fiend. So it was a very, very well placed charge, if I can pat myself on the back.
That was that was very well done, because it basically neutered anything I had to counter what was coming.
Mm-hmm. So the Questers piled in first. They killed all the clan rats. You had an opportunity to pile in with I think it was just one or two clan rats left in that little pile.
Yeah.
They did nothing. And I was able to use my 3-inch pylon to get into melee range with your warp engineer and your arch warlock, and then within 3 inches of Thankwell and your storm fiends, locking them all in combat to make sure that they couldn't shoot out of that for at least a turn. And then once you finally cleaned up the Dracolines, I would have Tempesters, Grand Hammers, and Questers ready. Longstrike still in the back, shooting you every turn. So this was a bit of a gamble, making sure I made, you know, two. There was a 7-inch charge on the Questers and a 6-inch rerollable charge on the Dracolines. But after failing a 7-inch charge, I felt like, okay, can't fail two, right?
Hey, you never know. 6-inch rerollable. Those are quite difficult to make.
I want to talk about how the Dracoline combat went for me. I did get Mystic Shield off. I didn't get Empower off this turn because Thankful's +4 Unbind is ridiculous. I was able to cast Mystic Shield using a whole bunch of primals, like all the primals I had that turn. And that Mystic Shield really paid off because when Thankful went in to punch me and when the Storm Fiends went in to punch me and all the heroes, they did like 0 damage. I think he did 2 damage total throughout all of it.
They're not terrible, but they're by no means good in combat. Like, I think Thankwell is Rend 1 on all his attacks, and the Storm Fiends are Rend 0 with their clubbing blows. So it's nothing too impressive.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, Clan Rats are Clan Rats. If 3 Clan Rats did a wound, they'd get a gold medal.
Well, between all the defense and Mystic Shield, I was able to keep them on a 3+ save, even through Rend 1, and that helped this pinning maneuver work. What didn't work was how their damage rolled.
you did the exact same thing you did with the Tempesters, and you got greedy.
Well, I had to split them in this case, right? Because of their positioning, there were certain things I had to hit. So one of the riders had to hit the Clan Rats or the Arch Warlock, right? So I thought, okay, I'll put the mount attacks into the Clan Rats, and I'll put the riders into the... Or sorry, other way around. Rider into the heroes, because he had a Grand Staff, and mounts into the armored guy. Whiffed completely. Clan rats. 2 Clan Rats survived. Or 1 even. It was so bad. I figured the 2 damage.
You did 0 damage to the Clan Rats.
Yep. They revived everything. They revived D3 models, which could have stolen the objective from me, especially if you piled Thankul on, right? Between Thankul and reviving D3 rats. It was possible that you just took this objective back, and that's why I have this Quester here on the left labeled as MVP. Because him counting as 3 models, just touching that objective, allowed me to maintain it even if you revived 3 models there.
Yeah, exactly. He did end up coming very clutch in this game.
Evocators just swung low. They left both heroes with 1 wound left. Yep. They didn't kill any Clan Rats. It was very, very poor roll. And then I had to choose, well, what do I hit with my Lightning Blast? And I could have killed the Engineer. I could have killed the Clan Rats just to make sure they didn't revive on top of it. I chose to go into your Arch Warlock, partly because he's a 2-spell wizard, but also because he's your general. And I know how much you want those Warp Sparks. I know how much you want that extra command point every turn that a general generates. I know all these things are important. It did open me up to a reprisal, and that's why I don't like killing people's generals with this kind of maneuver generally, because I don't want people to get a free reprisal off it. But it was there, so I thought, okay, let's just finish him off.
Yeah, and honestly, I think my biggest mistake here was when I had the after your evocators activated, I had the opportunity to run my engineer away using a Skaven ability, and I didn't do it.
Yeah, you just wanted to hit me instead, right?
I don't play a lot of melee Skaven, so I forget that the rule exists, but I think it's called Scurry Away. When you activate to fight in combat, you can choose to instead make a fallback move. So I could have just ran him 6 inches right out of combat back towards the Gnawhole.
Yeah.
But honestly, it completely slipped my mind, and that probably would have saved his life.
Yeah, especially after what happened next. So overall, my turn was pretty successful. I made all the goals I wanted. I had a contingency plan to cover up my possible failings. I felt like even if I didn't win the double turn here, which I never assume I do, if you won the next turn, your turn would be very difficult. You'd have to clear out the Dracolines. You'd have to get onto the Pulse. You'd have to get onto 2 objectives, which were covered with Questers and Tempesters and Aetherwings. Like, it's just lousy with Stormcast. So I thought this was a pretty successful turn overall.
Yeah, I'd say so. I think you did everything you needed to do and more.
Mm-hmm. Well, then we rolled priority and you won the roll off. And let's talk about your round three. So what were you thinking going into this round?
So round three was an interesting one. Thankfully won the roll off, so didn't get doubled, which would have just been game off the bat. And battle tactics got very difficult because, like I said, there's literally one achievable Skaven one, which is kill a monster, except your list doesn't have a monster, so that's gone. At this point in the game, surround and destroy is off the table. I've already done intimidate. I've done magical dominance. I'm not going to get magical mayhem because you have your dispel scroll up in my face, so any damage spell you're just going to say no thank you. So that basically left me with reprisal, which was, well, thanks for killing my general, at least I'll score 2 points. And then it was a quick hero phase. I think Thankwall just got some buff spells off. I don't think I got more warp power. I think you unbound that.
I did, yeah. I prioritized primal dice into that.
Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, quick hero phase. I had single clan rat left just hanging out there.
Well, in your shooting phase, you had to dedicate everything into killing the Dracolines.
Yeah, so in the movement phase, I gave that one unit of clan rats a quick jump back towards the other knothole, screen out my living cannon that had moved back through its own knothole. And that basically left just what was stuck in combat. So Engineer ate a Warpstone Spark, gave the Storm Fiends the extra damage, and here I was thinking, like, yeah, you know, who needs more warp power? All-out attack exists. And it didn't work out.
No, that was a lot of twos and ones.
That was... When you need a 3+ to hit, you know, you'll think you'll make 4 out of 6 dice on odds, but, you know, 0 is just as likely, apparently.
Yeah, there does or it doesn't. 50-50.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, wind launchers totally whiffed, which, to be fair, they probably would have wiped most of the Dracolines.
Yeah, even with +2 save, I would have been on 5, yeah, so it would have been nasty.
Because I think you had one down to one wound, and then it was just two more. So it's like, I need to do 11 wounds, and my shots are D3 plus 1 damage.
Well, in the hero phase, you killed one of the Dracolines. I don't remember what it was. You did something that killed one of the Dracolines, because this happened before you could retreat your Warlock Engineer. Because the Blaze of Glory killed the Engineer.
Oh, right. So, yeah, I thought I must have done Warp Lightning off the Engineer. That must have been it.
Yep. That sounds right. You killed one of the Dracolines.
It may have been an Arcane Bolt from Thankwall. I don't quite remember.
Yeah, I just know it was before you could retreat him.
Yeah, so hindsight, you know, maybe I shouldn't have done that, but... You know, at this point, I think the game was pretty much well decided. It was just, where can I get some points? So I wanted to make sure I killed those Evocators, including in the hero phase. And then, yeah, shooting, like, things didn't go too well. Storm Fiends whiffed completely. I think Thankwall chipped the Evocators first, because you still had 3 models. I wanted to max his dice.
Yeah.
And then I was basically left with a cannon to finish them off, which thankfully he did. Rolled the 1 finally.
Yeah, those 6 mortal wounds just finished them off, and I blazed and killed 2 more clan rats, but that was it. The Dracolines were gone. Thankfully, mm-hmm. though, that did, you know, all that shooting happens after movement, so you weren't able to move anything onto the objective, but since there was nothing left in range to shoot, you were able to charge. Unfortunately, Thankwall failed a 6-inch rerollable charge, which...
And that literally... That single charge cost me an extra 3 points.
Yeah, 3 points, because you didn't even have one objective this turn.
Yeah, so hold 1 and hold the pulse would have made this a 5-point turn for me. And yeah, no, it's a dice game. Rerollable 6-inch charges, not as likely as you think. So unfortunately, Thankwall failed that charge. Couldn't get on the objective because he's worth 5. It would have been nice. I wasn't even too concerned about killing the Liberators, honestly. In a funny turn of events, you killed the 2 clan rats. I had the 1 guy left. I rolled a 2 on the bravery, making his bravery a 4. He didn't run. And then I did bring back 3 whole clan rats, which would have taken me that objective if you hadn't moved that questor onto the point.
Yep. He is the
previous
MVP.
Turn. He is absolutely the MVP. And then, yeah, pretty much unfortunately kept me my score down to 11, and then I think we basically called it going into your turn, because now you just walk up and slap me.
Yeah, I was going to score 7 and probably just wipe everything else out. Would have probably pinned down your Storm Fiends. It would have been... I mean, there's opportunities to score more points, but yeah, you conceded and I accepted that, and we called it there.
Yep. So, that was a... It was a very slow game until it was a very quick game.
Yeah, it's the reason I wanted to talk about it in particular on the podcast is because it really shows just how flexible you need to be and how meticulous you need to be. Like, I was only able to do that because I was so careful with my first two turns, right? Staying out of very specific threat ranges. I had as many resources as possible. You did whiff a bit on shooting in round two, but like those liberators didn't, you know, they didn't really matter after round two. So
well they did, because yeah. they saved you that point.
Yeah, that's true. Well, that was your turn, so it wouldn't have mattered to me.
I mean, if they had died previously, cool. Then I can just have rats, that singular rat standing on that point with the three coming back. That gets me that point. But
yeah,
sure. Them living definitely affected the outcome.
Yeah.
So the shooting whiffing hurt.
Yeah, there was a series of odd dice rolls in both ways.
Yeah.
But it just goes to show that you gotta plan around this stuff. You gotta have backup plans, and that's partly why I was talking about this list, is like I want options, right? I wanted to run a 5-hammer list. I wanted to make sure that even if I fail a grand hammer charge, the game just isn't over. Even if I, you know, whiff on Tempestor shooting after dropping in, the game's just not over. I always have another thing coming that you have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a great time with this game. I thought it was very tactical, very, very chess-like in the way that we kind of were just positioning and posturing. And I had a great time.
We had so many people watching us for so long, just as we like slowly went through our movement phases. Thank God we weren't on clocks.
It was
your
tense.
Your brother asked me after, he's like, how'd that go? And I'm like, well, it was good until it wasn't. The slow part was going great. And then things picked up.
Slowly and then suddenly all at once.
Yeah. So it is I do like the battle plan. I find I did have much better luck with it in another matchup, because it was the same kind of deal. I faced Starborn Seraphon and they dismantled my army over a few turns, but he also just refused to move up. So he was castled. So I just let like two units of clan rats hold all the points. I scored max points until turn 4, and then he tabled me and he came back. So
yeah, if you don't have the kind of range, power projection and mobility, not even speed, but mobility that Stormcast have, playing a castle is a lot more difficult. Like when people were playing Lumineth all the time with these Sentinel castles, like they had a fatal flaw in that they just didn't control objectives very well. Mm-hmm. Like that's definitely one of the reasons Sentinel castles aren't very good this season, because I mean, how would they play this battle plan? You know, this would be brutal for them. Yeah, it'd just be terrible.
Yeah, and I think this battle plan is a good thinking game, and I think playing against Stormcast is always a good thinking game for me, just because I don't want to say Stormcast like counter Skaven, but just your ability, unlike 90% of armies in the game, to just sit outside my threat ranges until you want to be in my face is super annoying for me.
Yeah, just it's outside,
such a
right?
good skill.
Yeah. And because long strikes shoot 30 and cannons move 3 and shoot 24, there's a 3-inch buffer zone that you can just never get to, and long strikes will just pick off lightning cannons one at a time.
Exactly. Yeah, it is. Thankfully, I faced a similar Stormcast list in round 1. That guy wasn't as meticulous as you with his threat ranges, so that one I managed to pull out a high scoring game and a win. But yeah, what against a Stormcast player who's like you, really knowledgeable about his faction, it's a lot tougher.
Mm-hmm. I'm also very knowledgeable about your faction.
I think that's true.
That's a big part of it, right? Is I know exactly what to look for. If you're playing against Skaven for the first, or any army for the first time, and you don't know the ranges of movement and shooting and all these things, like it's a lot tougher. You know, any losing any unit in this game would have made it much more difficult. And you can, I'm sure you can attest to that as well. As soon as you started losing clan rats, it was like, oh, my options are diminishing. You know, I have to go all in at this point. And that strategy,
as you start losing screens, it gets infinitely more difficult.
Yeah.
Because everything I have is like they're not super easy to kill, but by comparison to other hammer units, is like they will crumble.
Yeah, with focus fire, anything in the game dies. Skaven probably quicker than other armies, I'd say.
Yeah, Skaven on the quicker end for sure.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast, Sarah. I had a great game, and hopefully we can do it again soon. Either with this list or another list or other armies, I'll definitely see you around at the game store.
Yeah, all right. Thanks for having me, Paul. You have a good one.
Thank you, everybody, for watching. We really appreciate you guys coming back to our channel. Thank you especially to our Patreon and YouTube supporters. If you think we missed anything or our analysis is lacking in some way, leave a comment down below the video or come join us in the Discord server and yell at us personally. If you want to talk about AOS, our server is the place to be. We post battle reports like this. We talk about models. We post our work in progress. We have community contests. If you're watching this video when it comes out, right now we have a painting and Torian Locust contest. So if you have a foot wizard that you want to put into the contest for your chance to win fabulous prizes, feel free to jump in there. We do list building for all armies, not just Stormcast, not just Seraphon. We have dedicated order, death, destruction, and chaos players that are very passionate about the game, very friendly people, very good community. Consider supporting the podcast by becoming a member on YouTube or joining us here on patreon.com/thestormkeep. For $5 a month, you can get early access to all of our videos and access to all the slides that we use in these videos as well. We've had a few people come back and tell us that our How to Counter series, they have it saved on their phone so that they can bring it up for quick reference when they need to play against Tzeentch or the armies that we feature. Coming up next on the podcast, we're working on How to Counter Khorne, and we are working on a video how to play Annihilators. Unfortunately, they didn't see play this game. They were in the list, but the game ended before they got a chance to drop in. But Mergonk has a lot of insight after playing Grand Hammers for a couple years, so we're excited to get that video out to you guys. There's always more coming down the pipeline, so stay tuned to the channel. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you in the next one.